Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, in episode 354, we are back with a preview of the August 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com. We discuss an issue focusing on suprachoroidal therapy, including suprachoroidal drugs for macular degeneration, uveitis, and other indications, including ocular oncology. I'm joined by my colleagues, Dr. Supriya Vakaria and Catherine Talcott. Remember, you can claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website, where you can claim those credits. And we have a list of financial disclosures relevant to this podcast in the episode description as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the August 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com. Joining me for this episode, two of my colleagues. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Kat Talcott from Cleveland, Ohio. Kat, welcome back.
Hey, nice to have you. Or nice to be with you.
Oh, it's nice. You can host if you want. I mean,
it's all you. All hosting is for you.
No. I don't mind at all. This is great. Priya, are you going to invite me in too? You've never really invited me. I got Dr. Priya Vakaria joining me from Tampa, Florida.
Hey, Jay. Thank you for joining today.
It's a pleasure. It is a pleasure to be here. So I brought four articles to you guys to discuss. I'm going to run through them. Remember, all articles can be found at retinalphysician.com. We are not going to go through these articles verbatim. If you want to read them, go ahead, but we will use them as jumping off points for discussion. We're going to start, the theme of this episode and this issue was suprachoroidal drug delivery. So we're going to start with this article by Arshad Khanani's team. Tyler Ewing, Hannah Khan, and Arshad Khanani put together an article kind of reviewing therapy in the suprachoroidal space and talking about gene therapy. So suprachoroidal delivery as a novel avenue for retinal gene therapy. We've talked about this a little bit in terms of the gene therapy options, so I won't belabor this, but talk a little bit about why the suprachoroidal space is advantageous and how you can access it. And we have now Viper, which is the first medicine approved by the FDA to be delivered by suprachoroidal injection. That's triamcinolone and acetonide. And then the idea of gene therapy vectors and viral vectors that can carry genes. And then you review these studies that have been done, Altitude, which is a suprachoroidal AAV8 study looking for patients with DME, with patients with DR without DME, for progression to PDR. And also talking about study results by AAV8, which was looking at wet AMD patients with suprachoroidal drug. And they kind of go through the early prelim results, which are very encouraging and really not major issues, although they did have four cases of mild IOA in AAV8 so far. These are designed to be one-time gene therapy treatments. Kat, I'll start with you. I think we're going to talk about gene therapy. I feel like it is the topic du jour, and it should be. I feel like probably anti-VEGF was the topic du jour in the early 2000s and mid-2000s. Gene therapy in the context of hereditary retinal disease was really a topic du jour in the early and mid-2010s. And I think in the 2020s, we're going to be talking a lot about gene therapy for the diseases we do injections regularly for, which is diabetic retinopathy, wet AMD, diabetic macular edema, retinal vein occlusion. Going forward, the suprachoroidal space does seem encouraging. You got a chance to review some of these trial results. Anything that stood out to you? I think we're all encouraged by them. We want to see more data. We need larger series, phase three trials, following up on the phase two results. Anything that stood out to you as flags or things you'd watch out for as we look at suprachoroidal gene therapy results?
No, I mean, I think this is a really exciting space overall. I mean, I feel like, I think we're all waiting for what that treatment jump is going to be. We have really good medications now to treat these diseases, but I think we're all looking for a way to continue good efficacy, but decrease treatment burden. I think we had all sort of hoped that like intravitreal agents such as Kodiak, and there's still more information to be gained on that front, would sort of provide us with more long-term acting options, but we really haven't seen that. So I think gene therapy is super exciting. So I think definitely subretinal and suprachoroidal gene therapy is definitely a mode of action that I think everyone's really excited about. I think the data here is very encouraging overall. And I think one of the benefits of sort of this delivery is that it avoids actually entering into the eye. I think one of the concerns that I have, and I'm interested to hear your guys' thoughts on this, is that, you know, to be honest, I haven't done a lot of suprachoroidal injections, but I have done them as part of sort of training for clinical trials. And it's challenging. I think it's a different skill set than we're sort of used to using in clinic. And so I'm sort of interested what the uptake for, you know, as these, as more agents become available in this mechanism, of how people, about how comfortable people will feel. I mean, I definitely feel comfortable doing intravitreal injections, but suprachoroidal injections, I think, are a little bit more nuanced in terms of the resistance and how knowing you're in the right space. So I think that's going to be kind of an interesting forefront here.
Priya, any comments? You know, Kat, you brought up a point I was thinking about, is what about, Priya, cost and storage, right? So are people going to be comfortable carrying, if this drug, let's say, expires as a shelf life of a month, I mean, how many of these reasonably? You would hope it'd be priced affordably. I do think that companies that invested a lot of money into this would try to price it as a one-time cure, and they would do some math and say, you know, the lifetime cost of injections for this patient would have been $150,000. So here's your $125,000 single dose syringe that expires in 30 days that you got to store in your fridge and hope there's no power outages over the next 30 days before it goes out. I'm curious, again, implementation on a wide scale, if the costs are significant, people are essentially with these humongous drug floats in their practices. Like, I'm curious how you think that will play out, or is this something that will be a one-off thing that you have one or two, and maybe you sort of sporadically spread this out? Because if it's done that way, even if you have, let's say, 3,000 retinal specialists and they each do one of these a month for, you know, a year, you're not really moving the needle much in terms of the actual disease burden of AMD or DR.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think you brought up two points. One is, how can you have an inventory of all of these, you know, increasingly expensive medications with newer technologies, and how many would you have on hand? You know, I think to start, as retina specialists get used to suprachoroidal therapies, I don't envision most clinics having one or two just on hand, because intravitreal therapy, you know, currently works pretty well. And we're, as Kat said, we're not very accustomed to injecting in the suprachoroidal space, but I think it all boils down to what ends up being effective. You know, it's interesting to look in the future because there's so many therapies that are coming out, not only suprachoroidal injections, but different intravitreals and biosimilars. And I mean, there's going to be so many injections that you bring up a good point, Jay. How many can people really stock in their clinics? And I think that's going to be something that we're going to increasingly struggle with as time goes on. But, you know, I do think that if it proves to be effective, and again, retina specialists are looking for durability. So if these treatments end up being efficacious and durable, then I do think we'll all make space for them.
And let's tie into this into the next article to move forward. We can continue the discussion of feasibility and how this will be implemented, right? This is suprachoroidal and subretinal, new developments in suprachoroidal and subretinal drug delivery technology. Trials in humans are progressing by the dream team at Mid-Atlantic Retina, David Chu, Ali Khan, and Colin Ho. This is kind of a more of a bigger overview of suprachoroidal delivery, and they look at all the different trials that are going on. They talk about some advantages, and they really then dive into the advantages in terms of not only gene therapy, but it's cell delivery. And they talk about this new technology, which is these catheters you can use intraoperatively, where you don't have to do a vitrectomy to access this space. You don't have to make a 41 gauge retinotomy insertion. You actually have this catheter developed by Gyroscope, which you insert this catheter into the suprachoroidal space externally. You extend it, you can visualize it directly with the chandelier without doing a vitrectomy, or theoretically, I guess using an indirect chandelier would be easier. And then you inject your targeted dose directly into where you want it to go, right by the macula, which is a nice concept. And again, the idea being you eliminate some of the complications of doing vitrectomy, especially if you start talking about younger patients, right? Especially these young IRD patients in the future, or young diabetic patients, for example. If you want to do this in a young diabetic and you really don't want to touch that hyaloid, you could go in and deliver a gene therapy with anti-VEGF, for example. And they talk about a couple of the trials, the RPE cells for lineage cell therapeutics, and also Janssen's human umbilical tissue derived cells delivered this way. And Kat, so again, this is about feasibility. Again, the other feasibility question that always comes up with subretinal gene therapy or subretinal surgery or port delivery system is, okay, it's not like we have an abundance of empty operating rooms and surgeons sitting at the wait to do all of these cases, right? If anything, there's an abundance of horrible detachments and PVR cases and other surgeries flooding ORs and ASCs. And actually the financial pressures are moving the other way. It seems every year the financial pressures are compressing what retinal specialists in different practices and communities are able to bring to a hospital or ASC setting. And the problem when you go to a hospital, as we've all seen, is you get bumped. You just simply do not take precedent over that that acute neurologic bleed or GI bleed that may bump your OR space. And so my question is, this is all awesome, but what is the actual impact going to be globally for patients if we're doing surgery in order to get drug into the correct space? Because I think it's a great idea in principle. I'm not trying to be a negative Nancy, but I'm just trying to visualize how many of these cases could feasibly be done in ASC. And what do you think will it look like from an implementation standpoint? Like, is this going to be just at Cleveland Clinic, Bascom Palmer, and a couple of places, or is this going to be something that any retinal specialist can do with their ASC?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think this is very interesting technology. It definitely furthers sort of our treatment advances, and, you know, it could potentially be great for the patient. I think PDS, now commercially available, is sort of a great example of this. But I think we're all sort of left with the question of, this is great technology, but sort of what do we do with it? And like, who's going to take this up? And to be honest, like, what's the financials of this? Like, is it worth it to do these cases in like an ASC type setting, or is it going to be more relegated to like academics? I think, you know, some of the finances of this will dictate things a little bit. I know the PDS thing is still sort of a work in progress and may work well for patients, but those are things to consider. I just wonder if technologies like this are first going to start more, as you sort of alluded to, more at academic centers where we're a little bit more immune to those sort of pressures than a private practice setting, and how much that's going to impact sort of what's the uptake in the real world of these technologies. So I think they're really good for patients, but I think the companies need to do a really good job of figuring out how to sort of practically get these into practice, and what the financial like reimbursement is going to be to make this accessible to a larger population.
I mean, I think they're certainly thinking about it. I get my inbox flooded with healthcare surveys from all these, probably indirectly, all these companies who are asking, like, would you do this? Would you do that? And Priya, I think CAT reference port delivery system, I think one of the big questions about port delivery system, take aside complications and safety, has been, it's not really reimbursed that well for what you're doing. And so if it's not reimbursed well, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it if it's better than standard of care, but it's arguable whether it's better than standard of care, and then you don't tip the financial sort of balance towards it. So then it gets harder to justify. Like Kat said, it's going to come down to how this is reimbursed. If it's not reimbursed, if it's reimbursed, for example, worse than a vitrectomy, which it could be because you're not doing a vitrectomy, you're simply doing, there's probably no code for this, and you may have to, it's hard to generate new CPTs from what I understand. They probably have to piggyback on the existing CPT. And it may be a CPT that no one uses now and isn't reimbursed well, like drainage of the suprachoroidal space or aspiration of subretinal fluid. And that would be a terrible thing because this is a procedure you don't want the surgeon to rush. You want them to take their time. And I think it probably could be done quickly in the right surgeon with good training, right? You put a chandelier in, you make your incision, you insert it. But I mean, you're still talking about a procedure that's longer than a cataract. And it needs to be reimbursed appropriately for that time. Otherwise, you're just not going to see this done. It's going back to that float problem. What ASC or hospital is going to keep a lot of these drugs on hand? Are they going to be willing to keep 10 gene therapies on hand for your 10 wet AMD patients coming today? God forbid one of them cancels. God forbid the drug is lost. God forbid it expires. Now you have hundreds of thousands of drug just floating over that ASC's head. These are the things that I think the science is so important, but I think these are the things we actually need to start talking about now as a field in our meetings. What is that actually going to look like practically in everyone's practice?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. You know, one of the things I'm seeing with the PDS device is it's not as easy to get a PDS device, not just from our standpoint, but definitely from the ASC standpoint. You know, it's definitely, you know, ASCs are not used to having medications on hand. They're used to having surgical devices. They're used to having things that are sterile that can be kept for years, but they're not used to having medications that are put in an OR, at least in an ASC, because many ASCs don't do, you know, some, they might have Intravitz, but they don't really have much more. So it's definitely been an uphill battle to getting at least the ASCs in our area to allow us to do the PDS and to also purchase it and have it on hand to have it available. You know, it's interesting. You know, I don't know how the field is going to change, especially because I feel like, you know, anytime there are these surgical procedures, there ends up being something that we can do in the office that can achieve a similar effect. And so it'll be interesting. You know, I think the concept is brilliant. And I think it can be used as a device for other therapies. You know, right now we're talking about gene therapies for PDR and for AMD. We're talking about steroids, but there's so many other things that can be developed. And so even if we don't utilize the technology now, perhaps it's something we'll utilize in the future for really select cases, such as, you know, specific gene therapies for things that are much more rare, like Stargardt's disease or retinitis pigmentosa.
That's a great point. But I think the reason that people are pursuing wet AMD and DR besides benevolence is it's a larger market share, right? So the companies understand that this is much more profitable than going after Leber's congenital amaurosis. As profitable as that can be for Spark, there's sort of a ceiling effect on that for that company. The sky's the limit if you're targeting a chronic disease that is increasing exponentially like DR or wet AMD. That's why I think the implementation is interesting. And my point is, one of the things that would be really advantageous with the companies, if anyone's listening, is the more shelf stable your drug is, the better it's going to do. Because ORs will stock, ASCs will stock IOLs, right? They don't mind buying thousands of IOLs in the library and keeping them in hand. And they may not be used for a while, but they're shelf stable for a long, long time. So the amount of cost they're eating potentially is much less. And they don't have to be stored in a cool refrigerator. They don't have to be stored in a circumstance that if the power goes off, you lose all those lenses forever, right? It can't be out in the sun, but it doesn't have to be at X temperature. I know that's going to be close to impossible when you're talking about gene therapy or cellular therapy, but like that also needs to be part of the thought process, is not just that it's efficacious, but if you want it to be implemented, it's got to be shelf stable. And let's tie this into our next article, suprachoroidal drug delivery and the treatment of non-infectious uveitis. Tolo Lopez Ashina and Steve Ye put this together. And this goes again into what you were just talking about, Priya, steroids, right? They talk about, you know, intravitreal drug delivery as the standard of care. And then they go into suprachoroidal, they talk about the peach tree and the results with the clear side, drug triamcinolone. And this ties into Zyper, which has been improved. And it goes through some of these results. And I suggest anyone who's considering using Zyper should read those results just to be familiar. One of the big things that's taken away from suprachoroidal delivery is the reduction of a lot of side effects we attribute to periocular and intravitreal steroids. I feel like steroids is much easier. I think anti-VEGF is much easier from a storage standpoint. I mean, I just wonder, Kat, shelf stability is something we don't talk about a lot. We don't talk about sustainability. We don't talk about if the packaging is green. We don't think about this sort of thing, but it is fascinating. And I'm curious, I hope the companies are thinking about this. I know they're focused on a bottom line, and it does tie into both the bottom line and what else will be available to retinal specialists. Because I imagine suprachoroidal steroids pretty shelf stable. You can have Triesence, you know, in your office for long periods of time before you use it. I don't know if that's going to be true for, you know, a viral vector.
I think that's a really important point, because if we can't keep this stuff in clinic, if we have to special order everything, and it has to be sort of out of our normal sort of routine for ordering things, then it could be like, you can do the easy thing. You can do an Ozurdex, you could do a Triesence, or, you know, you could special order and plan for something more, you know, that's more time consuming. And I think it's going to really prevent people from like uptaking this really exciting technology that can really sort of benefit patients overall. But I think it's a consideration that sort of we don't talk about. And even when you're sort of looking at the clinical trials for things like this and the sort of gene therapy, you don't really think about what it's going to look like in reality. But in all honesty, like these are the things that affect adaptation and integration of this technology. And so I think it's really important to sort of pay attention to it. I think the uveitis space is a little different than sort of the AMD DR space, in that I think uveitis providers are used to sort of jumping through some extra hoops and planning in order to get people the treatment that they need, you know, prior authorization for immune suppression, retisert that require sort of special ordering, going to the OR. And so I think it's a little bit different space where these providers and patients are often, that's kind of the reality. But I mean, I think that those are really important questions that you raise that people need to think about in order to make sure that this exciting technology is actually utilized.
I'm going to just end this last article and we can talk more about suprachoroidal. I cannot claim to be an ocular oncology expert at all. And I just think it's interesting to reference this article. I suggest anyone who thinks it's interesting should read it. It's called About Light-Activated Suprachoroidal Therapy for First-Line Treatment of Indeterminate Lesions in Small Choroidal Melanoma by Besser and Demirci. Basically, just to summarize, and it's very interesting and way smarter than I can make it sound here, but you can take these virus-like drug conjugates that are light-activated. You can inject them suprachoroidally. You can activate them and essentially try to target either lesions that you're suspecting could be melanoma that are kind of indeterminate or target small melanomas. This is obviously not something that would replace plaque radiotherapy and nucleation for large tumors, but could treat some of these smaller tumors in a very targeted manner. And I think, again, a very brilliant sort of application to try to affect the retina and choroid with suprachoroidal delivery. They also talk a little bit about it, Dan, that there may be advantages to using this for choroidal metastasis, which is also fascinating because, again, those are patients who often get systemic chemo, but also PDT radiation. And this may, again, may be a safer potential option for these patients. Priya and Kat just made references to steroids and implementation. This is, again, more niche. Now we're talking about uveitis, oncology. I think that, and I'm not meaning to be repetitive, I think those make a lot of sense. And we even saw it with Zyper. Zyper succeeded where when they tried to use suprachoroidal triamcinolone for RVO, they didn't meet their endpoint. They could not beat the standard of care. And that's going to be one of the biggest challenges. Like Kat was saying, you have in-office options that work really, really well. It's very tough to show superiority to those options. And when you can't show superiority, whether that's in a trial to the FDA, or to clinicians who need to adopt therapy, or to insurance companies that need to pay for the therapy, gets a lot harder to start justifying costs versus in uveitis and oncology. I think they're so niche and the baseline treatments are so expensive anyway and have their own risks that you can maybe fit into that space a little neater, but the new delivery mechanism. So I think this article is interesting because it shows another way to apply it in a very niche way, but it shows the contrast for me between what we're talking about with bread and butter everyday retina clinics versus, again, something super specialized. I think you might see a stratification in what is actually implemented, as fascinating as it is as a route and as a scientific way to approach retinal vascular disease.
Yeah, I mean, I think the unique thing about the oncology space is that our standard of care can cause significant vision loss with radiation retinopathy or other radiation side effects. And so this is definitely a novel technology for patients who otherwise, you know, we have treatments, but they're not ideal treatments. And so this is something that, you know, I feel is definitely worth the time. And, you know, when you compare to the current standard of care, if this ends up, you know, panning out, that it could be a nice tool to have as an oncologist. And so I think that, you know, the suprachoroidal space is definitely a space we're going to utilize. I think it's still going to be interesting to see what we utilize it the most for, but, you know, overall, I think that it's something that's office-based, that's relatively easy to do, you know, once you're kind of used to the injection technique and getting the right angle of the needle. So I do think that some of these niche areas will definitely have broad uptake.
Yeah, any thoughts on this paper or to wrap up our discussion on suprachoroidal therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really exciting for this area. I mean, there's only so many treatments available, and I think this really moves things forward where there's something that's more available in the clinic than there was before. So it'll be interesting to sort of see how this is utilized, but I think it's a really exciting advancement.
Priya, you guys need to buy a bigger fridge for every office. That's what's going to happen. I mean, seriously. Wow. I mean, that goes down to the questions. How many, like right now, it's pretty simple right now, right? Like, I guess you have Vabysmo, but let's say 5 years ago, you stocked Avastin, Lucentis, Eylea, you stocked a steroid, and then that was kind of it. Or maybe you had a couple steroids, and now it's like, yeah, we have Vabysmo, but now if there's going to be biosimilars, there's going to be suprachoroidal drug, maybe gene therapy. And you're going to have to stack all of this because there may be step therapy. There may be patients who aren't good candidates for gene therapy. So you still need to have your base drugs. And so, and then you need to have numbers. You have to have space. You have to have inventory. And the float, so I keep going to float. I don't deal with float in academics. And Kat, you don't hopefully deal with float. But someone is dealing with float, whether it's an academic or practice setting. That's a big financial risk that you're taking, and it should pay off. But a lot of practices really suffered in COVID when everything shut down because they had significant drug float. And it's like, well, what do we do with all this money we've been borrowing against the companies, right? It's only going to increase the bloat a little bit. It's good. It's great for patients, I just don't know what's going to happen outside of a hospital settings, and hospitals don't have infinite amounts of money either. And they're not going to approve everything under the sun if they feel like it's a financial liability. Like I know for Alluvion, for example, where they stocked a couple at a time, mostly because it wasn't used that often, but also because it's significantly more expensive than the other drugs. And we're a pretty large eye hospital. We weren't really stashing 15 or 20 Alluvion in our pharmacy. Priya, bigger fridge.
So I think it's not only just the fridge, right? So the fridge is one component of it, but also think about the work our staff has to do to get all these different prior authorizations and to sort out which insurance company requires step therapy. And now what do they require step therapy with? Is it with Avastin? Is it with a biosimilar, and which biosimilar? So it's going to get pretty complicated. I forgot who it was, but there was someone who gave a great talk at the Business of Retina meeting this year who talked about the oncology space. And their experience with biosimilars. And they just found that it is a much bigger logistical hurdle for the staff and for inventory. So I don't know that we'll have a choice, but it'll definitely require a little bit more manpower.
Yeah, I think the biosimilar stuff is really going to be interesting because there's so many. And like, our insurance company is going to pick the same ones. Are we going to, as institutions?
The answer is they won't. They will not. And like, they will make it as complicated as possible.
What are you supposed to do? I mean, I don't know, at least as like large academic institutions, like, you know, our institutions, Jay, can sort of like, we can, like our main insurance providers can sort of hopefully use their weight a little bit, but it's going to be such a nightmare. We'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. It's also going to be interesting. Like, this is completely off topic from this article, but, and I don't want to take this. It's going to be interesting. How does that affect sort of our mental sort of algorithms? Like, I feel my algorithms are pretty simple right now. Fewer options. I'm like, I do this. And if that doesn't work, I do this. And then I do this. This is like a branch, right? It's like, and we get a lot of second and third opinions. I'm sure you guys get too. So they come in and usually can sort of figure out what drug they're on, even if you don't have records. It's going to be impossible to figure it out now. Like, it, you know, all the drugs sort of sound the same. BioViz sounds like BioView, and patients don't know what they're getting. So it's going to be really hard to kind of judge response and comparative responses. And you know, there aren't great trials that we talk about that are like biosimilar versus another biosimilar versus on label versus Avastin. Like, we don't have those head to head studies. It was enough of an achievement as a field that we were able to do like protocol T or score two and like do some, or Levo and do some head to heads. Like, no one's going to do a head to head. There's no incentive for any company to do a head to head against a biosimilar because they wouldn't want to show that it's even. It'd be horrible for them. So I'm saying there's cost issues, insurance issues, and then there's like, practically speaking, like, I don't know, maybe the biosimilar is fine. Maybe it's not fine. I don't really know. It's going to be patient dependent on how they respond.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it's going to get complicated, and then you're not even including the new intravitreal therapies that will likely come out.
Wasn't life so much simpler like in 2020? For many reasons.
But the good thing is, I think I envision in 10 to 15 years, our patients are not going to need Q4 week injections anymore. And you know, that's a huge success because it really, you know, I don't even like brushing my teeth once a month, you know, let alone coming I brush my teeth twice a day, but I was trying to think of a good analogy and that was a terrible analogy, but you know, it must be terrible to come in and get an injection every month.
Wash your car.
Yeah. I don't like washing my car. I mean, you know, I don't know.
I don't wash my car every 4 weeks. I think I'm in trouble, but you know, I mean, it's like in clinic, like our technicians will be like, this person's already back. You know,
it totally messes with your head as a retina specialist. I have no concept of time. So fun. Sometimes I'm like, didn't I just see you? And it's been like a year and a half. And there's other people I'm like, man, it's been so long. And they're like, I was here like 4 weeks ago. I'm like, oh, or they had surgery 2 weeks ago. It's like, I think because these patients, they're like, we see so many different people and then they have such different intervals and some of them are such frequent flyers. It's kind of a mind trick where you're like, I'm not really sure when I saw you, but I feel like I saw you pretty soon. Then you look at the chart, like, oh, you were here a month ago and you were here the month before that. And you were here the month before that. So yeah. And especially I think COVID outlined, we do need more durable therapies, especially in situations where patients can't get their treatment. So Kat and Priya, thanks so much for joining me. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate you guys spending a little time going over these articles with me, and I hope to see you back soon.
Thanks for the invite, Jay.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Talcott Vakharia, Listeners, remember, you can find all 354 of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. They're all there, easily searchable and in categories. You can also find our mailing list where you can sign up and get email updates on the most recent episodes. You can find us on social at Retina Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook. And you can also subscribe in your favorite podcast app on your mobile device. Remember that we love feedback. So if you have feedback for this podcast episode or other podcast episodes, you can always reach out by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the contact us link on our website. Remember, we can also love those reviews you leave in the Apple Store. If you can leave positive reviews, always good to hear. And we'd love to give thank yous out to now. Thank yous to Dr. Justin Ma, who produced this episode, Drs. Angela Chang, Louis Kai, and Mike Vinicasa, the OG3, who have taken care of so much over the years and for this episode as well in terms of production and social media. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.